Okay, folks, strap in because we are headed for some wild stuff in this episode. Our tour of church history now takes us through some, well, bizarre regions. And that's why I've titled this episode Crazy Stuff. Pseudo-Dionysius the Areopagite was an influential theologian and philosopher who wrote in the late 5th to early 6th centuries. His work had a huge impact on medieval theology and mysticism. He wrote under the pseudonym Dionysius the Areopagite, who was an Athenian convert of the Apostle Paul mentioned to us in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts. But the label pseudo was added later when it was realized that the author of his writings was a poser, a pretender. At the core of Pseudo-Dionysius' teaching is a unique synthesis of Neoplatonism and Christian theology. He presented a vision of God that emphasized divine transcendence. Pseudo-Dionysius said that God was ineffable, that means beyond describing, inexpressible. And more than that, God was utterly beyond human comprehension, even language. And this concept is central to his negative, or what's called apophatic theology, which approaches God by negation, that is, describing God by what he's not rather than what he is. You may remember that the Gnostics of the second century said that it was the acquisition, the attaining of secret knowledge that imparted enlightenment. In his work titled The Mystical Theology, Pseudo-Dionysius reversed that. He said that knowledge stood in the way of enlightenment. The mind was a barrier to spiritual advancement, not a tool to obtain it. He said the path to salvation proceeded through three stages: purification, illumination, and union. First, he said, the seeker needs to be purified by stripping him or herself of all earthly and fleshly entanglements, and then by extreme forms of meditation in which the goal was to wipe the mind clean and clear. That special moment would arrive when the person would achieve illumination and they would realize their union with the divine. Now, the crucial difference between Gnosticism and the mysticism of Pseudo-Dionysius is that while the Gnostics obtained enlightenment by gaining knowledge of something, Dionysius said that enlightenment came with realizing one knows nothing. God can't be known because he surpasses knowledge and language. Confused? Join the club. Pseudo-Dionysius developed an elaborate celestial hierarchy detailing 9 orders of angels that were arranged in 3 groups of 3. Now, in terms that sound similar to what 2nd century Gnostics said, this angelic hierarchy serves as an intermediary between God and humanity, transmitting divine illumination downward. His work titled The Celestial Hierarchy had a lasting influence on Christian angelology and medieval art. His third most influential work is titled The Ecclesiastical Hierarchy. There, Pseudo-Dionysius applied a similar hierarchical nature and structure to the church, emphasizing the role of sacraments and clergy in mediating divine grace. He saw the liturgy and sacraments as earthly reflections of celestial realities, allowing humans to participate in the divine life. Now, the concept of divine names is another key aspect of Pseudo-Dionysius' thought. So in a work titled The Divine Names, he explores various scriptural names and attributes of God, arguing that while these names reveal something of God's nature, they ultimately fall short of capturing God's essence. This work influenced later medieval discussions on the nature and limits of religious language. Pseudo-Dionysius' teachings on beauty and light as manifestations of the divine had a lasting impact on Christian mysticism. He regarded the material world as just filled with symbols that pointed beyond themselves to spiritual realities. And of course, that encouraged church leaders to interpret scripture allegorically rather than literally. The Monophysite Christians of Alexandria were the first to draw inspiration from his work, supposing them to be, well, genuine works of one of the Apostle Paul's disciples. The Byzantines followed suit and incorporated some of his ideas. And then in 649, when Pope Gregory I and the Lateran Council accepted them as dating to the first century, they became more widely looked to as informing Christian theology abroad. Now, this synthesis of Christianity and Neoplatonist concepts had a huge impact on Byzantine theologies of mysticism and liturgy, on Western mystics, on scholastics and Renaissance thinkers. Pseudo-Dionysius' writings were translated from Greek into Latin right around 850, and became foundational texts for medieval scholasticism and mysticism. John Scotus Erigena, Thomas Aquinas, and Meister Eckhart. They were deeply influenced by his ideas. But they were rejected as inconsistent with the Bible by the Protestant reformers and exposed as 6th century forgeries when scholars dug into their origin. But their emphasis on the mystical, it had already done its damage in the Eastern Church, which continued to hold on to many of pseudo-Dionysius' ideas. And even to this day, salvation in the Eastern Orthodox Church means something rather different than it does in the Western Church, where it's conceived of as redemption from sin and reconciliation to God. Well, in the Eastern Church, salvation is regarded more as a return to a process of spiritual transformation enhanced by the church, its priesthood, icons, rituals, to a destiny that produces a being that is much more than human, though not quite attaining deity. The Eastern idea is that the redeemed won't be gods, but will be God-like, a distinction really without a difference. This process is known as theosis. While this is really an oversimplification of a complex theology, it helps make the crucial distinction between the ways of the Western and Eastern churches and how they understand salvation. The West sees the work of Christ primarily as salvation from sin, while the East understands it as salvation to glory. And again, maybe that's a gross reduction of the complex soteriology of the Eastern and Western theological traditions, but it's pretty accurate nonetheless. It's all in where the emphasis is placed. The Bible does say that Adam and Eve were created in God's image, and we know that Christ came to restore what they lost in the fall. Certainly, the redeemed in glory will appear as, well, glorious creatures that dwarf the shades that humans are now. We are, as one artist put it, like ghosts on the earth, compared to the glory that was once Adam's, and will be the domain of the redeemed yet again. But in Greek Orthodox theology, salvation seems to be not just a restoration of what was lost so much as a promotion into something new, something even more glorious than the first man and woman enjoyed. Again, something above human, if not quite divine. And the emphasis on the mystical in the Eastern Church is all about how to make that leap, a kind of spiritual form of an evolutionary quantum leap. In 650, as pseudo-Dionysius' views were being heavily imbibed in the East, a church leader named Constantine, obviously not the emperor of the 4th century, well, he resurrected some of the heirs of the Gnostics. Constantine and his followers rejected the formalism of the Byzantine state church, claiming a desire to return to the simplicity of the early church. To which we might say, wait a minute, in 650 they wanted to return to the dynamism of the early church? Isn't that the early church? That was 1400 years ago for us. Constantine based his beliefs on the Gospels and the letters of Paul alone. In a kind of reheated version of ancient Marcionism, he claimed that an evil deity inspired the rest of the New Testament and all the Old. In a reprise of Gnosticism, he claimed this evil deity was the creator and God of this world. He said the true God of heaven was opposed to the physical universe and that the material world was unalterably evil. In order to save people's spirits from the wickedness of the physical world, the true God sent an angel who appeared as a man named Jesus. Well, a little history taught church leaders how to, well, shut down Constantine's re-emergent Gnosticism. All they had to do was go back and read the early church's struggle with the Gnostics and how all these ideas were old hat and had no basis in Scripture. While a few church leaders did just that and waged an apologetic battle with Constantine's followers, the state church persecuted them and at times even executed them. So Constantine changed his name to Silas, one of the Apostle Paul's associates. After Constantine Silas was stoned to death, the next leader of the sect took the name Titus, another of Paul's assistants. When he was burned to death, a third leader took the name Timothy. The next adopted the name Tychicus. All of this leads to the sect being called the Paulicians. During the iconoclast controversy of the 8th century, the persecution of the Paulicians eased a bit. One of the emperors may even have been a Paulician. But in the 9th century, the Empress Theodora ordered the Paulicians eradicated. Tens of thousands were killed, mostly in Armenia, where they had set up shop. In reaction, the Paulicians formed armies that proved, well, quite capable in battle. Unable to conquer them outright, the Byzantines offered them independence if they would move to the troubled border with the Slavs and the Bulgars that were giving the empire grief at that time. the Paulicians ended up having a major religious impact on the Bulgars. These Bulgar Paulicians became known as the Bogomils, named after their first leader, whose name, of course, was Bogomil. In the mid-10th century, Bogomil taught that the firstborn son of God was Satan. Because of Satan's pride, he was expelled from heaven. God then made a new heaven and earth in which he placed Adam and Eve. Satan then had sex with Eve, which union produced Cain, the source of all evil among humans. Moses and John the Baptist, according to the Bogomils, were both servants of Satan. But God sent the Logos, his second son, Jesus, to save humanity from the control of Satan. Although Satan killed Jesus, his spiritual body was resurrected and returned to the right hand of God. Satan was in this way defeated, said the Bogomilians. Now, some of our listeners may find all of this somewhat similar to another religious group headquartered today in a certain state in the United States that has great skiing during the winter and a capital located next to a large, salty inland sea. It turns out that Solomon was right. There really isn't anything new under the sun. The Bogomils adopted a rigidly ascetic lifestyle. They despised marriage, although they permitted it in the case of less than perfect believers. They condemned the eating of meat and the consumption of wine. They rejected baptism and communion as satanic rituals since they used material things. Now, Bogomilism flourished in Bulgaria while it was an independent country in the 10th century and then again in the 13th. Bogomilian ideas spread to Western Europe, where they influenced the Cathars and the Albigensians. When the Turks destroyed the Bulgarian Empire in 1393, the Bogomils pretty much disappeared. But the Paulicians continued in minor enclaves in Armenia all the way into the 19th century, and it's possible that in some corner of a rural community, Paulicians continue to find adherents. And I trust you now see why I have titled this episode, Crazy Stuff.